From the Sky News Centre at 5, six police officers in the US city of Baltimore will be charged over the death of a black man injured while in police custody. One of them faces allegations of second-degree murder over what happened to 25-year-old Freddie Gray. His case prompted violent protests in Baltimore. At a news conference, State Attorney Marilyn J. Mosby said Mr. Gray should never have been taken into custody.
Lieutenant Rice, Officer Miller, and Officer Narrow failed to establish probable cause for Mr. Gray's arrest, as no crime had been committed by Mr. Gray. Accordingly, Lieutenant Rice, Officer Miller, and Officer Narrow illegally arrested Mr. Gray.
Battle lines have been drawn over possible coalition talks after next week's general election. Anna Jones reports from Westminster.
Ed Miliband told BBC Question Time he'd rather not be Prime Minister if it required SNP support.
We're not going to have a coalition. We're not going to have a deal.
But ex-Tory PR chief Tim Collins says he couldn't go it alone.
The idea he could govern for 5 years without understandings with the SNP is just simply too implausible for words.
Lib Dem Nick Clegg found it funny both the Tories and Labour still believe they can win outright.
If either of them still think they're going to win a majority, they need to go and lie down in that darkened room.
And David Cameron says he wouldn't lead a government which doesn't deliver his pledge of a referendum on EU membership.
Police have asked that a report into how Jimmy Savile and Stuart Hall carried out abuse at the BBC isn't published for the time being. It should have been made public later this month. A former MP has been convicted of assaulting two teenage boys in a shop in North London last autumn. Eric Joyce, who represented Falkirk, had denied attacking the 14 and 15-year-olds in Camden. One of soul music's biggest stars of the 1960s, Benny King, has died. The singer, who was 76, will be best remembered for his hit Stand By Me. In cricket, England are having a difficult first morning of the final test with the West Indies. A few moments ago, they were 56 for 3 after choosing to bat. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
BCFM 93.2 are your local radio station, which is why we're bringing you unrivaled coverage of the local and national 2015 elections.
I'm one of the firstborns around here, and they've got everything.
The local issues.
I'm privileged to be Bristolian.
The national agenda.
I think community radio is a very, very valuable instrument.
Uncontaminated by the mainstream media, we ask the questions that you want the answers to, in a way that only BCFM can.
I'm glad BCFM is here to share it with us.
What would you like to know? Send your questions to election@bcfmradio.com. BCFM. We hear from our youth MP and explore the perspectives of our diverse communities.
Gypsy travellers and Eastern Europeans have made Bristol home too.
Hear the politics show on Fridays at 5 p.m. with Tony Gosling, and listen to Breakfast at 7 in the morning and Getting Bristol Home at 4 p.m. every weekday afternoon. We'll also be running an election special on the night of May the 7th into the early hours of the morning to bring you all the latest local information and results with reporters at all of the counts. Plus, on-the-spot interviews and an array of studio guests alongside our host, Matthew Tosh.
The only way to make a change is to actually say something.
So for impartial, hyper-local, up-to-the-minute coverage of the closest and most exciting election in years, there's only one station to choose. And why take our word for it? We're the Sony Gold Radio Academy best small station in the Southwest. BCFM 93.2, your official 2015 election station.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's General Election Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. This week we spend 2 hours until 7 o'clock with parliamentary candidates from four of the five main parties: Labour, Lib Dem, Greens and UKIP. I'll be asking some of the questions gleaned from our political reporting, such as 9/11 and secret societies, which you're less likely to hear asked in the mainstream media, and also giving all today's participants a chance to explain their party's vision for the country. I say four of the five main parties because although they were given almost 2 months' notice, the Conservatives have failed to put forward any of the city's parliamentary candidates for today's discussion. Bristol and South Gloucestershire Conservative office at Westfield Park explained they're all at a pub politics event in Bristol North West with Conservative candidate Charlotte Leslie tonight. 3 weeks ago we had a similar situation. On Friday the 9th of April, both Conservative and UKIP councillors were invited to discuss that week's news, but only UKIP put a councillor forward. I'm disappointed because this is the first campaign in this show's 6 years of local and general election coverage that any of the city's five main parties have left us with an empty chair. And in the campaign, we've twice lacked a Conservative voice. However, that's their choice. Alongside Conservative, Labour, Lib Dem, Green and UKIP, Bristol has former merchant venturer Mayor George Ferguson, of course, who describes himself as an independent. He's up for re-election next year, as well as several Independents for Bristol candidates in next week's ballot, as well as Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, Left Unity, English Democrats, British National Party and Vapors in Power, who are campaigning for e-cigarettes too. Some are standing in the BCFM area, but outside the Bristol city boundary. On to our election discussions in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, mostly dry, with some light rain. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, cooler and wet and windy. On Saturday, scattered showers, windy but more sunny spells on Sunday. Highs of 16 degrees Celsius through most of next week. A mainly cloudy week with plenty of showers. Next weekend, 9th and 10th of May, highs of 18 degrees Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So around the table we have representatives of the four of the five main parties standing here in next Thursday's general election. Conservative Party have not put anyone forward for tonight's discussion. For Labour, sitting MP in Bristol East, it's Kerry McCarthy standing again. And standing for the Liberal Democrats in Bristol South is Mark Wright. Green Party candidate in Bristol North West is Justin Quinnell. And finally, standing in Bristol South for UK Independence Party, it's the chairman of Bristol UKIP, Steve Wood. Hi, all of you. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi. Good evening. Thank
you. First of all, I'll start with you, Kerry. Why should we vote for you? What's your party's vision for Britain?
Well, I think it's something that's actually very relevant to the part of Bristol where BCFM's offices are located, or studios located, in that, you know, we think that we need a rebalancing of the economy. So it's not about just the rich reaping the rewards and then expecting that to somehow trickle down to the poorer people. This government has hit the most vulnerable, the poorest sections of our community, the hardest, with things like the bedroom tax. Ed Miliband was in Bristol this morning, once again reaffirming that it would be one of the first acts of a Labour government would be to repeal the bedroom tax, as well as other measures like raising the minimum wage, pushing towards a living wage, rewarding employers that would do so. And it's really about it's about that. You know, there'll be ways of making the rich pay their fair share, so abolishing the non-dom rule, introducing a mansion tax on homes that are worth more than £2 million, reinstating the 50p rate of tax. And it's all about making sure, we see in Bristol there are areas of the city that are very affluent, people doing very well and can perhaps, you know, have the luxury of getting by quite nicely no matter who is in government. But we see whole swathes of people that are really suffering, and our public services too. We've said that we would repeal the privatisation of the NHS, and that would be another one of the first things that we would do.
One of your main things there is the bedroom tax. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, well, this bedroom tax effectively is something that people in private accommodation can't have anyway, so why should people in social housing have it?
I think the difference is when it applies to people in private accommodation, it's that the housing benefit is set according to what their need is likely to be and the homes that they then go looking for. What you see in social housing is people who've actually been in that property for a very long time, and it's quite cheap housing. You know, I've had people come to me affected by the bedroom tax who their rent £65 a week, and then they suddenly get asked to pay £13 a week towards that. They don't have that £13 because they're on very restricted incomes. These were people that were approaching pension age and had disabilities. If you push them into the private sector, you are not going to get something for £65 a week in the private sector. You're going to be paying well over double that, I would say, for a bungalow. So it just doesn't make sense at all to... And there aren't the one-bedroom properties available. These were people that had an adult disabled son who needed to come and stay with... He was in residential care, but they wanted him to stay with them during various periods during the year, which is, you know, entirely normal for a family to want to have that spare bedroom for him to be able to stay there. So it's completely cruel, and it's silly policy as well, because as I said, it ends up costing the council far more if they've got to pay housing benefit for people to go into the private sector.
Okay, Mark Wright, you're standing for the Lib Dems in Bristol South. What's your particular pitch? Why should we vote for you?
Okay, thanks, Tony. I would say there are three real reasons why I would ask people to vote for me. The first is I believe in a fairness agenda. I think in this country we're still asking too much from the people who don't have very much, and we're still not asking enough from the people who have quite a lot. And I would agree with a fair amount of some of the things that Kerry said when she was talking about rebalancing the economy. The second, though, is I think Lib Dems have a policy of changing the economy in a way which is responsible, and that means balancing the needs to get the deficit under control now, and with the responsibility of not simply kicking a huge debt bundle down to our children to deal with. You know, our current generation has made some mistakes, and we've lived beyond our means, and it's up to us really to put that back in order rather than just booting the problem down the road to the next generation. And the final prong of my pitch, if you like, is that we also believe in doing this inside a framework of environmental responsibility. So we are strongly in favour of promoting renewable energy, of cutting carbon dioxide emissions, and of restructuring both the way we live and our economy so that we can live in a sustainable way in the future generations.
One of the main questions for the Liberal Democrats is bound to be in many people's minds: what have you actually achieved by being a coalition for the Conservatives? Mm. I think people want to see something concrete, because one of the main pitches before the last election, of course, was about getting rid of tuition fees, and of course the opposite happened, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Our policy was to scrap tuition fees if we could. We didn't win an overall majority. Neither the Labour nor the Conservative parties were interested in scrapping tuition fees, so we weren't able to fulfil that. And I'm sorry, Nick Clegg is sorry. Pretty much everybody in the Lib Dems is very sorry about that, I can assure you. We've taken enough kicking for it. But we did the next best thing, which was to implement a tuition fee system, which is effectively a graduate tax.
So what are you most proud of that you've got out? Coalition,
yeah, I think
that wouldn't have happened if the Conservatives had been on their own.
Yeah, I'll mention a few things then. One of the first things I'm very proud of is the change in the way we tax income. We've dramatically increased the income tax allowance in a way which reduces the burden substantially on poorer people, and we've recovered that money by bringing in various capital gains taxes and other tax tweaks, which are quite complex, but which recover that from people who are much more wealthy. I'm very pleased about that, because that's aligning with my fairness agenda that I mentioned earlier. Another thing I'm very proud of is the fact that we've tripled the amount of renewable energy that's generated in this country over just 5 years. That's the single biggest increase in the amount of renewable energy generated in this country in history. And that is quite remarkable, because, you know, the Conservatives, and I need to be perfectly honest, they're not here to defend themselves this afternoon, and that's fine, but they kicked and screamed and resisted all of the environmental measures we were trying to push through this government. We recently had an open letter written to the media by 20 leading renewable energy companies calling for the Lib Dems to be part of any future coalition, because they were so pleased with the amount that's been done on renewable energy.
Okay, Mark. Green Party candidate in Bristol North West is Justin Quinnell. Justin, why should we vote for the Green Party? Why should we vote for you?
We sort of sit in this space, this essential space, which is between social justice and environmental sustainability. It's where both of those mix, and we have a long-term vision. We're actually looking far ahead. I mean, going through the austerity and stuff, we believe equality is more important than growth, and that's how we're different from the other parties, the idea of growth and stuff, the idea that somehow you can sort of grow your way into wealth and things like that. The Earth's resources are finite, and that's a pretty obvious thing, but it's one of the things that is ignored when it comes to, let's say, perpetuating the growth sort of approach that everyone else has got. We're currently using, in the UK, about four times the amount of planet each person. If the whole world used that amount, then we'd need four, like three extra planets and stuff. It can't carry on that way. So what we're doing is basically sort of thinking to ourselves, right, how can we evolve things for a low-carbon future? How can we evolve it so we actually get a bit more equality in society and stuff? So we would obviously not cut any more welfare and stuff, and actually sort of invest in jobs, in ecologically sustainable jobs and in environmentally friendly jobs, to actually sort of like get the workforce working towards a sustainable future and stuff.
So, Justin, are you pleased about the announcement this week that the UK economy might be weaker than the Eurozone for the first time in 4 years? You seem to be implying, and maybe there's some truth to it, that actually growth is not good. We've had figures this week saying that the opposite is happening as regards the 2010 general election, where growth seemed to be picking up at the tail end of the last Labour government. What's happening now is the opposite. Growth is now going down at the tail end of the previous coalition, Conservative Lib Dem coalition?
It depends how you're measuring growth. Right now we measure growth as, you know, things that are sort of like disastrous and stuff, the amount of sort of fuel and stuff, the amount of rubbish we create and stuff. There's loads of things which we include in GDP which are actually very destructive both to environment and to society. We have to sort of reassess how we measure success in our economy, not just simply growth at all costs. I was down in Falmouth last week, of all things, and there were ships outside. You can see them. What they're doing is dumping all their old sort of dirty diesel and getting new diesel before they get into the waters of the UK and stuff. And, you know, that is all part of, let's say, the growth thing. The growth thing, if you just do not look at the actual damage that a lot of it has done and do not include that within your sort of like the way you measure success, you're going to end up with a, you know, rather like this morning, looking at the M32 chock-a-block and just knowing what it's like in Beijing and places like that. We're going the same way.
Okay, standing in Bristol South for UK Independence Party, chairman of Bristol UKIP, Steve Wood, why should we vote for you? What's your party's vision?
Well, we believe that the UK has been let down by the three main parties in the last 40 years. We believe that the UK is good enough to govern itself, ourselves. We don't need to be governed from an outside source such as Brussels. 75% of our laws are currently made in Brussels, when we believe that no law should be made in an overseas land that will reflect on us. We believe we should be making our own laws. So in particular, South Bristol has been let down desperately. It, up until about 3 years ago, it had a high unemployment, high drug rate, and I'm pleased to say that is actually being brought down. Great incentives are happening over in South Bristol. However, it's still not getting the government funding it needs, and I believe that we need to bring in certain areas of the private sector that will help train our young, retrain the unemployed, and get people back to work. In relation to the benefits system, we believe that distress can happen to anybody at any time. And we would continue to fund the benefit system as it is. We would protect it from benefit fraud across the board, and we would cut down on benefit tourism as well. We would include a five-year embargo on benefits for anybody coming into the country to stay here permanently or to get a visa. We believe that if you're coming to a country as a visitor or as somebody to stay here, that you should have health insurance. We have paid into the system. People coming here have not.
David Cameron for the Conservatives is pitching for we will have an in-out referendum. So why aren't you voting Conservative?
Because you cannot have an in-out referendum after January 2017. It's going to be physically impossible, and then you blame the EU. We already have QMV that we can't do anything without the other 28 majority.
What does that mean, QMV?
Quality majority voting. And if we don't have consent of all the other countries, they're all 28, we're not going to be able to withdraw fully. There are two ways that we would like to withdraw, and that's an amicable divorce for 2 years, and we have 2 years on entanglement. If the European Union decide they don't want to go down that road, we repeal the Maastricht Treaty and we just leave.
Let's start on this Europe issue, because I'd like to hear from everybody about it. What are your thoughts, Justin, maybe you first, on this issue that Steve's brought up there, about whether it's actually going to be bad or good for Britain if there is a vote and we do decide to pull out of Europe? I think there's quite a lot of people in other parts of Europe that are thinking similar things, particularly the Greeks are thinking about pulling out of the Eurozone, you know, the currency zone, and there's a little bit of a wave of at least people thinking about seceding from Brussels.
Well, we do, I think, need to have a vote on whether we stay in or come out of the EU. We do need to. There's big problems with the EU. It's the Commission's completely undemocratic, and that's wrong. You know, we need to be able to sort of, let's say, I mean, as a Green Party and stuff, we would like to change the EU to stay with, let's say, the good sides of it. I think all of us want to keep the good bits and get rid of the bad bits. That's one of the awkward things.
But can Britain survive on its own outside the EU, or is it now so totally dependent economically on the other part of the structure?
We need to be able to build smaller societies. If you're trying the globalisation idea, the idea that everyone's going to sort of grow more and more and be more involved with everyone else, well, we've got that sort of like, you know, web-based stuff and all the rest. So when it comes to being able to create sustainable societies and sustainable communities, we need to look inwards more. We need to make sort of smaller areas more democratic, more independent, rather than looking at big mega states and stuff and then involving, let's say, America into big trade deals as well. I don't think we need to have this idea of like it being one particular big mega block that we have to rely upon.
Mark Wright, if there was a vote, which way would you vote?
I would vote to stay in, absolutely. I think if we left the European Union, it would be a disaster for the economy of this country. The overwhelming majority of all of our trade is with Europe and will always be with Europe because they're right on our doorstep. And the way we get involved with managing and determining the trade regulations that are involved with all that and all the rules that go on is by being inside the EU. I'm absolutely in favour of reforming the EU. There's a lot that needs reforming in there. You mentioned the Council of Ministers, which is clearly a fairly undemocratic setup at the moment. There's a lot that needs to be reformed. But leaving the European Union would be a disaster, I think. We've already got a situation now, so it's law, that if any powers are ceded to Europe, there has to be a referendum on that particular item. And I think that's a good thing, because I think, we have ceded some powers to Europe, which were probably unnecessary, and, the European Union is doing what all powerful bodies do, which is starting to meddle in things that it shouldn't be meddling in, and I would like to see a return to the kind of, in Europe it's called subsidiarity, but everyone else calls this the principle of federalism, which is that bodies only deal with the things which are best dealt with at that level. I'd like to see more things probably dealt with at a national and subnational, local and city level that are currently being dealt with too high.
For Labour, Kerry McCarthy, which way would you vote if there was a vote? Say the UK Independence Party got a sweeping majority and decided next week to do a vote on whether to stay in or out of the EU.
I would vote to stay in. I think that Britain has gained a lot from its position within the EU. And I just think more is to be gained by cooperation and working with other countries, particularly when you have, China coming to the forefront now and America still being a powerhouse.
But you can still cooperate, can't you? Because, for example, Iceland isn't, and also Norway and Switzerland, they're not in the EU, but they still cooperate.
They're not in the EU, but I don't think they have some... It's partly about cooperation to benefit the UK. So as Mark said, I think it's 54% of our trade is with the EU. The fact that Britain has so many international companies based here in the financial sector, for example, is because we are a gateway to Europe and to the European market. So if we're not part of the single market, they would choose to go elsewhere. Europe's also been... in some ways it was our saving grace during the Thatcher years with things like the social chapter in terms of protecting workers' rights and health and safety. And if you look at some of the environmental legislation, the animal welfare legislation, the food safety directive, all that sort of thing came out through the European Union. And as I said, during the Thatcher years when working people were being hammered left, right and centre, it was the one saving grace that we could go to Europe for protection there. So I think a lot is to be gained. I agree that there is also the need for reform. We've said that, our policy is if there's another treaty proposed which would hand more powers to Brussels, then we would have a referendum. But in terms of reform, as the situation is now, the common agricultural policy is the most obvious one. It's given millions of pounds in subsidies to the wealthiest landowners who don't need it. It's propping up an uneconomical farming system, and it's not actually protecting the natural environment.
Okay, Kerry,
so that would be one thing.
Steve Wood, for UKIP, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I did. Mark, you said it, and both Kerry said 54% of our trade is with the EU. That's total nonsense. Read the Antwerp and Rotterdam effect. Anything that comes into the country or goes out has to stop at Antwerp or Rotterdam. They then have their goods reclassified as coming from or going to the EU. The actual trade with the EU is going down, and we need to be looking at trading with the Commonwealth and other countries. Now, we don't need to be in a European Union to have a trade agreement. Look at the North American Trade Alliance. Those countries actually trade with each other. They have the same sort of thing that we wanted, which was what we were told as a lie, to be a free trade agreement. They're all in the North American Trade Alliance, and yet they're not in a political union. You do not need to be in a political union to try and trade with each other. And one final point, Kerry, you're saying about everything that happened not only during the Thatcher years, but during the years after that, where the European made rules and regulations. Are you saying that as a UK, we are incapable of making our own rules and regulations to protect people, that the British people don't have that capacity?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is we live in a global economy. If we wanted to introduce better working conditions, if we wanted to introduce things like the minimum wage, if we want to protect working people in this country, it is helpful if we then negotiate and try to deal with these things en bloc with other European Union countries. I mean, Ed Miliband has said that one of the things he wants to tackle if we're elected next week is to make sure that employers here can't exploit workers from the EU accession countries by somehow getting around the minimum wage legislation and paying them less, which would undercut the terms and conditions and the wages of British workers. It seems to me eminently sensible that you work with your closest allies, your neighbouring countries, to make sure that they lift everyone off the bottom, so it's not a race to the bottom in terms of workers.
Okay, we're going to draw we're going to draw a line under the EU there, because we had quite a lot of discussion about it. I want to move on to something which you won't hear on the BBC and other places like that, and I'm going to refer to the 2008 bank bailouts, because we often hear about these talked about as the crash. Of course, it wasn't a crash, it was a bailout with our money. Those banks didn't collapse. They got a lot of money from the public purse to keep going, nearly $750 billion, in fact. Nearly 500,000 people live in Bristol. I mean, that's 450,000. It's about the same population as Iceland, which I mentioned earlier on. The Icelandic government have arrested and jailed several top bankers for fraud. They've cancelled what they say are fraudulent debts, which those bankers run up. And Iceland's economy is now recovering strongly. If we weren't tied to Westminster, could Bristol and should Bristol have done the same? I think I'll start with you, Justin Quinnell from the Green Party.
Well, that sounds good. Yeah, I quite like the idea of that.
I'll also mention that there was a big inquiry into post the bailout by Andrew Tyree, Conservative MP, at the Commons, I think is it Finance Select Committee, Economic Select Committee, Treasury Select Committee. And he decided 2.5 years ago that they were going to split retail banking and casino banking, and that simply hasn't happened. So anyway, Justin.
It's interesting you mentioned the word casino, because the whole thing's based on gambling anyway, it seems to be, the sort of like betting on money and stuff and trying to sort of keep that going. I remember the iSave thing when that was sort of like more percentages and everybody was diving into it. That relates to Iceland as well. No, we probably could. I think if you want to try and get sort of like hand power back to local communities and stuff, you could probably hand the economic power back to local communities as well. Bristol may well do quite well with that. But when it comes to sort of the bankers and stuff, yeah, they're the people who are guilty. They're the people who went and sort of like got the money, and basically now everyone's suffering from it. The austerity is like, you know, making the fifth wealthiest nation in the world, I think the UK is, or supposedly, and we've got this sort of like poverty everywhere. I've got this thing here, more than one in four children growing up in poverty and stuff, and austerity and cuts are still being mentioned, and they're still the sort of little bribe for voting for specific parties in this election.
Everybody's being told there's not enough money, but we're the sixth richest country in the world.
And it's not that much money as well. No, let's just basically think to ourselves what it was like after the war. There was sort of like billions of pounds to sort of rebuild and stuff. And
well, it's interesting you mention that, Justin, because the previous head of the Bank of England, I always call him King Mervyn, Mervyn King, he said that the 2008 collapse had an effect on the British economy like a world war, like we'd fought a world war. Anyway, Kerry, what do you make of what's happened to the banks and the failure, really, to separate these two types of banking? That is, the casino banking, which is largely investment banking and speculation, from the money that we save and that we put in the high street banks.
Well, I think there is an issue, and certainly it was the sort of thing that Alistair Darling was looking at, and we've conducted reviews on in opposition. The Andrew Tyree's chair of the Treasury Select Committee, they can only make recommendations, and it would have been for the Conservative government to take measures forward. So that's why nothing's happened on that. And in America, you had the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banking from retail banking, and that general concept that no bank should be too big to fail, which is what happened then. I mean, the reason, yeah, we had no choice but to bail out the banks, because if we hadn't, it would have been ordinary people. We already started to see queues outside Northern Rock, people trying to withdraw their savings. So it wasn't that we wanted to do the bankers a favour and rescue them. It was about rescuing people whose life savings and their very livelihoods were tied up in the financial system.
But at the end of
what
the day,
we want to make sure is that we have a system where that we don't reach that crisis point again. And I was a member of the Treasury Select Committee, and I remember Eddie George and Mervyn King, you know, the people who were running the Financial Services Authority, coming in front of the committee and me questioning them about they really understood the risks within the banking system, and particularly some of these financial products, the derivatives and so on. And they gave quite complacent answers, and they almost thought that I was asking the question because I didn't understand how the markets work, whereas I do entirely understand how derivatives work. And I think there was real complacency. So obviously we need a system of regulation where that can't happen again, and that would include separating out banks' different functions, if need be, to ensure that they're not so closely intertwined.
Okay. What about one of the major problems that caused it, Kerry, and that is the failure to have proper sets of books made up on the banks, because what was happening was giant black holes were appearing in these banks' sets of accounts, and yet the auditors weren't picking up on it.
Yeah, well, that was I worked in banking quite a long time ago. I was a lawyer. But it was one of those things that you saw then. You had the traders who were at the cutting edge of what was going on. And you saw it with Baring Brothers when that went under. And I was actually called in to help try and sort out the mess afterwards, looking at all the contracts to see who owed who money. And it was clear then that the management of the banks didn't understand what the traders were up to. And so they were several light years behind the traders, and then the bankers, the regulators, the Bank of England at the time, were like even further behind in terms of not grasping.
So was there an aspect
going on
where the management and the board of these banks was saying, well, actually, we don't care how you make the money so long as you make
exactly.
it.
It was all about the bottom line, and so long as Nick Leeson, who was the main the trader that caused the Barings crash, as he was bringing in big profits for them, they didn't really care how.
So
he
what
did
will
it.
Labour do if we vote for you to do something about the bankers?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, one of the things that we have said is we will introduce a banker's bonus tax again. We tried to, it was the UK government that was lobbying in Brussels for there not to be a cap on bankers' bonuses. I think it was that we were arguing that they shouldn't be allowed to have a bonus that was bigger than their income or twice the size of their income, which is still a huge amount of money. But imagine if your incentive when you go into work is to get a really healthy-looking bottom line at the end of the day, so you get a massive bonus. You are going to take risks. You are going to cut corners. You are sometimes going to veer into illegality. So we want to curb bankers' bonuses because we think that's something that really encourages that risk culture.
Are you going to stick them in jail?
Well, that's obviously for the courts to decide rather than politicians. I'm sure you wouldn't want a system, Tony, where politicians could just bang people up without justice being done. But I think that there's been an issue,
in the past. Public prosecutions
in the past, there's been a real issue, going back to the days of the Serious Fraud Office, was actually really poor at bringing prosecutions. It didn't bring very many at all. And then in most cases, Ernest Saunders, everyone remember him? And his
Guinness.
Exactly. So I think there's a lot to be said. One of the problems is these so-called white-collar crime trials are incredibly expensive, go on for a very long time, and juries find it quite, you wouldn't want to give up a year of your life.
The judges say the jury, it's too complicated for the jury, and then they get rid of it. Anyway, Steve Wood for the UK Independence Party, what do we do about the bankers and the banking sector?
There's no denying that we had to bail out the banks, otherwise we'd have had a massive problem, probably six times worse than we already had.
But I mean, they're private businesses.
Yes,
if they go bust, surely they should just be allowed to go bust like your business would if you went bust.
If I went bust, nobody would come and save me.
And the shareholders lose their money.
Yeah, but we're not talking about just normal shareholders. We're talking about people's savings. We're talking about their livelihoods.
But the government guarantees those up to a certain extent.
To a certain extent. But there are the wealthiest in the nation who would still lose their money.
So the bailout essentially then was for the wealthiest?
No,
the people
I think the bailouts were there for everybody, regardless of who you were. What I would like to see is bankers held to account. Let's take the LIBOR rate. When the LIBOR rate came, it was being falsely inflated. Anybody who had a mortgage was subject to that problem. And I think that the people concerned should have been charged. I think they should have been charged with false
accounting. What about the foreign exchange fraud?
I think it should all they should all be charged with
about PPI fraud. I mean, it's been a whole succession of frauds that have been caught.
And if they're proved to be fraud, then those people need the weight of the law to come down on them. Nobody in this country, I don't care who you are, whether you're a high court judge or a road sweeper, nobody is above the law. The law of the land is if a fraud is committed, you should be charged.
But a lot of people looking at the City of London would say a lot of these blue blood bankers are above the law.
Well, I disagree with that. Nobody is above the law, regardless of what colour your blood is.
Should be or is above the law?
No, then nobody is above the law. Everybody is subject to the law of the land, no matter how high born or how low.
So how come the prosecutions happened in Iceland, bankers went to jail but not here?
Because I think people are being protected. That's not a conspiracy theory. I think they're too high up to consider the fact that they are being protected.
Too big to jail?
Possibly. Possibly.
Anyway.
I mean, we could argue that toss, but I personally think no one is above the law regardless of the crime. Okay. You commit a crime, you do the time.
Okay. Mark Wright for the Lib Dems.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, could I say at the start, actually, Vince Cable, the Lib Dem business secretary, was quite strongly in favour of splitting the retail and so-called casino banking sectors.
But you were
sectors.
There in the coalition.
No, indeed,
why
he was there.
Happen?
Well, unfortunately, the Chancellor has a say in the matter as well, and he was a Conservative and he wanted none of it. I mean, maybe if there's a Lib Dem Labour coalition in the future, that's something that can be looked at again, because I do think that is an issue. One of the things you did mention the auditors earlier, and there was no doubt at all that auditor, the Big Four or whatever they're called, you know, that was a cosy club where it was in none of their interests to start rocking the boat.
Well, maybe it still is.
Yeah, I think, not enough has been done on that, to be perfectly honest. Unfortunately, that's a problem that goes beyond Britain as well, because they're, the same Big Four are active in America as well. And I absolutely think there should have been more legal consequences. You know, you mentioned some of these various frauds that we've had. The Forex and the LIBOR ones were absolutely disgraceful. And there were some pretty big fines handed out to the banks, but those fines, actually, in the grand scheme of how much money they were making by perpetrating those frauds, were not really a big deal. You know, I mean, if you steal £1,000 and the fine for that is £100, that's not a deterrent.
You're going to do it again.
That's not a deterrent,
isn't it?
Yeah,
those fines are pennies to these people.
Yeah, exactly. And
I think
there probably should have been.
There should have been some more legal consequences. Accountable.
Yeah, absolutely. For the directors. I mean, I would be absolutely in favour of that. I mean, the Iceland situation is interesting, and it has some relevance because I'm on the council, and of course the council very nearly got burnt. They had some of its money in the Iceland bank. As well, so we were involved with finding out what was going on there. But it was quite a specific situation where it only really involved two banks, and they were perpetrating a very particular fraud which actually turned out to be quite easy to prove, and they got clobbered because of that. The problem in Britain is that there are so many institutions all looking out for each other, in the way the finance industry works in the city. It's extremely difficult to prove it in the way that it was provable in Iceland. I think if it had been that easy, I'm sure we would have seen it. But, I mean, I think there's definitely more that we can do. In fact, even America has been tougher on some of the big firms than I think Britain has. So, the IRS in America is actually very aggressive sometimes in going after tax fraud.
But, I mean, we're in a worse situation, Mark, with the economy now than we were in 2010. We've roughly doubled the national debt. I mean, there's been all this talk about, we're going to reduce the deficit, but the national debt has been going up and up and up and up. It's now, I think, is in at £1.5 trillion national debt, all this money owed to the banks. We're never going to pay it off, surely.
No, indeed. I mean, I think everybody knows that the national debt is never going to be paid off. No country has ever paid off its national debt.
I heard the current Prime Minister, David Cameron, earlier this week saying we are going to pay off the overdraft. That seems to me to imply that he's going to pay off the national debt.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking nonsense. Nobody thinks that Britain is actually going to pay off £1.5 trillion of debt. The thing which is important is getting down the deficit, which is the rate at which that debt is growing. It's, countries can handle having a national debt of between-ish 50% to 100% of their GDP. If you go above 100% of your GDP, the people you owe the money to start getting very worried, and the rate at which you borrow starts going up, and you end up in a situation like Greece. If you're below, if you're below 50% of GDP of debt size, then that's absolutely great, and good on you. The important thing, I mean, everybody knew in 2010 that the national debt was going to balloon, because at that point, when the Labour government was voted out, the deficit was £160 billion a year. only 5 years previous to that, the entire national debt was only about twice that. I mean, we were cranking in extra debt at an astonishing rate.
Isn't there a case at some point for a write-down of this debt? Just say, oh, forget it.
What, everybody in the world write off their national debts?
Well, at least Britain. I mean, that's, we've got some kind of control over. Kerry, what do you thoughts?
You're talking about Britain putting itself into bankruptcy
yes.
process.
I think the people who we owe the debt to might be we've had a lot of pain over the last 5 years with austerity. It seems to me almost like all pain, no gain, when we've doubled the national debt virtually during that time. So
yeah.
How can we carry on?
Well, I think
surely we just say, no, we're not having any more of this.
That doesn't work, Tony. But I think the key thing is that, you know, austerity doesn't work either, in that if you know, it's basic Keynesian economics, that you do not slash the public sector when the economy is weak, because you need to invest at times like that, because if you invest in construction jobs, if you invest in people working in the public services, that keeps people in the private sector in work too, and you don't have a welfare bill that's going through the roof. So it was entirely wrong to rush. We warned George Osborne that when he said that he said he was going to eliminate the deficit within 5 years. He's only just about, he's not quite managed to halve the deficit in those 5 years, and he's borrowing a huge amount more than he actually planned to do so. So that proves that austerity doesn't work. What we've said is we want to try and balance the books. We will try to reduce the deficit year on year, but not this mad rush towards doing so at the expense of economic growth.
Well, one of the things that Iceland has found is by giving more money to poor people, they spend it, whereas if rich people have more money, they don't spend it. Anyway, Justin, your thoughts on the...
There are a couple of things, really. I mean, it's just the idea that, let's say, every country in the world has this massive debt, so the whole world's got a massive debt. I'm just wondering sort of which planet we actually owe this debt to. You know, is it some sort of like, you know, somewhere else off the surface of the Earth?
We owe most of it to the banks, don't we, and to the IMF.
It's all there, and it's all this sort of hypothetical stuff. But the other thing as well, just a couple of words that sort of like, I felt the hairs on my back, my neck going, was this idea of bonuses. And it's just the fact that there is so much, you know, poverty around the place, and there's still talk and discussion about this bonuses business. You know, the idea that people in companies can earn hundreds and hundreds of times more than other people in that company or whatever, it just seems completely utterly wrong. We need to look at a way of being able to sort of share the world fairly, rather than sort of like allow this idea that some people can have a huge amount and some people have nothing.
Steve Wood for the UK Independence Party. What are we going to do about this virtually doubling of national debt over the last 5 years?
Well, you can't borrow your way out of debt. There's no way. If you remember back in the 90s and the early 2000s, there was all these wonderful adverts for going around for borrow more money, pay off all your debt, when you're just increasing your debt. You have to have some form of austerity. And I've said it once and I'll say it again. We talk about billions and billions of pounds being spread around, and the average householder doesn't get the figures because it's too many noughts. Let's take it to be like your home accounts. If at the end of the month you don't have enough money left over to pay your bills, you have to cut back. And that means that next month you'll have a little bit more. You don't turn around and say, I'm not going to pay anybody this month, so next month I'll pay double.
Well, sometimes people do, don't they? They say, well, literally, I cannot afford to pay it, and then they have to go to a debt advice service, sometimes go bankrupt.
There is that to it. And if people have to go bankrupt, then that's it. But it doesn't wipe off the debt. It doesn't actually make it go away. It doesn't make life easier. It just makes it sort of disappear for a while. But if you go bankrupt, you have charging orders put on your property and things like that.
But on a national scale, on an international scale, for example, this has happened in Argentina, it's happened in
Russia. Yes, but if we went bankrupt, our loans wouldn't get wiped off it automatically. The lenders would put charges on things, and they would expect that to be paid back. When we get into a situation, you must have some form of austerity, but I don't think that the cuts as severe as they have been. If we do things slowly, if you do things carefully, you can make a lot more difference.
Kerry, Steve just said that you can't borrow your way out of debt. Sorry.
Did I suggest that?
Well, you were suggesting that we would be spending more. Government would be spending more, and that would help the recovery.
What we've said is we wouldn't borrow To fund current expenditure. There might be a case for borrowing for investment. So in the same way that the last Labour government built more schools and hospitals, and that infrastructure spending is important. We want to be building, the aim is to be well on the way to building 1 million new homes by 2020. And by 2020, we'll be building 200,000 a year. And those are homes that are really badly needed by people, you know, in Bristol as well as elsewhere. So sometimes borrowing is the right thing to do, but the key thing is to make sure you've got money coming into the coffers. And those things I mentioned earlier, like the mansion tax, like raising the top rate of tax to 50p, not going ahead with the Tories' plan to cut corporation tax by a penny, even if it goes back up to 21p, it will still be the lowest in the G7 by far, way low. I think America is on about 36% on the moment. So measures like that, a levy on the tobacco companies, and as I said, the banker's bonus
and
tax,
also,
that brings in money to the coffers.
What about
and
uncollected
spent on,
billions of
well,
pounds of tax?
Well, 7.5 billion yeah. of tax avoidance, and I've said we'll abolish the non-dom rule, which should have been done a long time ago, to be fair. We're not saying that the entire 7.5 billion could be recovered, because people, you know, it's not an easy task to, you can't just sort of straight away put your hand out and the money comes flowing in, but there's certainly a lot of money there that we should be recovering.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. I mean, it's really interesting actually listening to Labour candidates over the election period. They spent 4.5 years railing against cuts and railing against austerity, and then Ed Miliband comes out with their manifesto and, of course, commits the Labour Party to 5 years more austerity and 5 years more of some small cuts, not big cuts, but small cuts. And I think, you know, Labour candidates that are elected are going to have a lot of difficulty explaining why their rhetoric in the last 5 years and the election campaign doesn't match up with what they're actually planning to do under Ed Miliband. Now, I have to say that what Ed Miliband is proposing is actually pretty similar to the Lib Dem plan in terms of getting the deficit under control and the way that that's going to be balanced with tax rises and spending restraint. And I think that's quite good. I'm quite glad that the Labour Party has at least sort of started to come to its senses, although, as I say, I don't think that they seem to have passed on the message to their candidates at
the
moment.
On to a look now at our foreign policy and some of the background to it all. The 9/11 attacks back in 2001 pitted the West's military against the Muslim world in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Middle East and North Africa, particularly bringing chaos now to Iraq, Syria and Libya. But were the Twin Towers and World Trade Center Building 7 brought down by fires or by explosives in the buildings? So-called controlled demolition. Well, the US architect Richard Gage, who represents 2,300 architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, says it's impossible for fires to bring down those three buildings on September the 11th. Last week, he gave a presentation, quite literally explosive evidence, he called it, to the International Affairs Society at Bristol University, where I caught up with him.
You have anti-terrorism laws here in the UK that go all the way back to 9/11, just like ours do in the US. Any of us can be arrested, held indefinitely without a right to a lawyer or a trial. We can be disappeared, basically, even tortured. This is not acceptable. So the MPs have to be educated. They have to know what really happened on 9/11. And we have to break through the denial and the subterfuge that we get from some of our elected representatives. Some of these people actually know what's going on, and they're just lying about it. So the BBC is complicit in covering up the truth about 9/11. In fact, they announced the collapse of World Trade Center 7 20 minutes before it even happened, and they had the reason for the collapse. They apologized for this grievous error, citing the confusing events of the day. You pay your license fee to the BBC for fair and balanced and accurate reporting, and we have not gotten it with 9/11.
A lot of people will be saying, Richard, this is 14 years ago, a long time ago. Can't you just let it lie?
There are wars that were started. 400 English soldiers have lost their lives, 6,000 U.S. soldiers. There are wars that are continuing as a result of 9/11. If there's any question about what happened back there, and there are hundreds and hundreds of very solid questions with very flimsy or no answers, then we've got to reopen the investigation. We've got to find out exactly what happened to those buildings, because that's the easy part. I think, as an architect at least, I can see, and I think anybody can see, that those buildings are blowing up in the case of the Twin Towers. In the case of World Trade Center 7, they're imploding. It's very easy to see once people actually get a chance to look at the evidence, and especially in the presentation like we're giving here tonight at Bristol University. The whole world has changed since 9/11. We're engaged in a police state. We are heading in the wrong direction. We are going to get another 9/11 type attack if we don't expose the first one. We'll deserve what we get if we allow the truth about 9/11 to be swept under the rug of history.
Well, I'm afraid I wasn't there to find out what the Bristol University International Affairs Society made of Richard Gage's presentation. He represents about 2,500 architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. But I'd like to go around the table now, starting with Mark Wright from the Lib Dems, to ask what you think about what really happened on September the 11th. Do you think we need to reinvestigate that and how it's affected our foreign policy ever since?
Sure. Well, I'm a scientist, Tony. I have a degree in chemistry and a PhD in astrophysics. I mean, I took quite a detailed interest in some of the stuff that was being looked into when they did the investigations. And I know this is a favourite topic of yours on this show, but I've got to say, there's absolutely no way I can believe that the established story is not correct. I mean, the steel girders that hold up the World Trade Center were originally coated with a flame retardant insulant, which is designed to protect them against fires of the kind that they were expecting in a building. Steel is, of course, exceptionally strong material. It can hold up a 100-story building easily, except for when the temperature of that steel goes above 1,000 degrees, because above 1,000 degrees, steel actually becomes quite plastic and can give way quite suddenly. If you've got a kitchen, for example, and you've knocked it through to your lounge and you've had a steel girder put above it, the building regulations these days say that you have to have that girder coated in some way or other with either some foam or some other building materials, which protect it against kitchen fires, because it's understood that even in the context of a kitchen fire, that if that girder gets above 1,000 degrees, it could buckle and the walls in your house could fall down. And that is simply what happened in those buildings. The force of the plane crash was so huge that it simply blasted off this flame retardant and insulant from the steel girders. And that meant that they was exposed to the fire caused by the kerosene from the planes, in the plane's fuel tanks. And unfortunately, after the exposure for half an hour, as it was, an hour for the other building, the steel simply gave way and they collapsed.
What about the what's happened since? Because there's been this thing called the War on Terror.
Yes, indeed.
It?
I mean, I marched against the war in Iraq. I think that the reaction of the Americans and of Tony Blair and the Labour government at the time was completely the wrong reaction. I mean, I understand why they went after Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, and I think that was probably justifiable. To then suddenly widen the whole remit to basically include everyone that's ever annoyed America in the last 40 years, which is what it effectively became, was ridiculous and massively, massively counterproductive. It has not only stoked up a load of hornet's nests all across the Middle East and Africa and Central Asia, churning out now thousands and thousands of motivated terrorists who are coming and causing us all sorts of trouble, but it also destroyed our international reputation of the Security Council, the British and the Americans in particular, and leads to the situation whereby we've got Vladimir Putin invading effectively and destabilizing his surrounding countries. And then we stand up and we say, look, this is an absolute disgrace. You can't just send your troops into another country. And he says, oh, what? Hold on. What, you mean like you did in Iraq? And we've got nothing to say. We've got nothing to come back on that because we have ruined our reputation.
Justin Quinnell for the Green Party, what are your thoughts about September the 11th itself and the repercussions?
My first thoughts are teaching at University West of England, doing a workshop, having a lovely morning, going out, eating my sandwiches by the deer park, coming back in and all the students had disappeared to a television room and seeing it all happen there and then. That's my first thoughts, and knowing the World Trade Center and doing photographs underneath it and through it and stuff like that, and It was somewhere, it was, you know, okay, it epitomised sort of what was probably worst in the world, which is world trade, but it was also an amazing space. The actual environment of being there with this sort of like building a third of the mile up above you, it's still something I can never forget. I used to have a friend who had a flat in Battery Park, and we used to sort of stay there, which is right below it. So I've got to agree, I like a good conspiracy theory. I don't think that's one. I think that's the sort of thing that people will come up with, which will have a massive effect, as it did.
Well, one of the things Richard Gage says is, for example, is you can see the fires are virtually out by the time the building collapses, and also there are steel poles, kind of parts of the building, are being projected outwards as if with explosives.
Yeah, I still think it's the sort of thing people would do. I think that, like, flying planes into buildings is something somebody had the idea of, and they thought, right, we'll do it, and they did.
What about the consequences for places like Afghanistan?
There's a few words here. Tony Blair and George Bush. And just thinking about George Bush right now, and it's almost like thinking about Thatcher and stuff. You think this was serious. Tony Blair and George Bush came up with this idea of almost destabilising the world. You know, just it's absurd. You know, the way their policy was basically in a very sensitive, sort of very changing world. As I said before, their foreign policy was basically based on lies, ignorance and aggression. And, you know, we haven't got a leg to stand on. It's absolutely hideous. And if you look at also the way that, let's say, you know, we've backed some countries in the Middle East and not others and stuff, you know, it's left us, in a way, evolving in this incredibly sort of changed world, which, you know, how we encounter now and how we encounter the future is stuff we're going to have to just sort of like live with. I mean, when it comes to the militarisation side of stuff, though, if we do get a chance of saying sort of we shouldn't have Trident, because Trident won't do any use against terrorism. It's not to do with that.
Well, people will say, won't they, that the Taliban have beaten a lot of the forces that went over there with AK-47s, so Trident missiles not really going to help. Mm. Kerry McCarthy, what's your thoughts about what really happened on 9/11 and the reaction to it since?
Well, I have to say I agree with the others. I don't think that there's much credence to the theories that the visitor to Bristol University was putting forward. In terms of what happened since, I mean, far more recently, I wasn't in Parliament when the vote was taken to go into Iraq. That was in 2003, obviously, and I didn't become an MP till 2005. But I was there for the vote on Syria, where actually not just David Cameron, but also President Obama at the time, I think, were committed to taking action in Syria.
That's 2013.
Yeah, and I think that and it was Labour that took the lead in saying, actually, this has got some quite disturbing echoes of what happened around the time of Iraq. There wasn't the international consensus that action was needed, and above all, there wasn't a clear idea of what intervention would achieve. And I think the difference between Syria and Libya, which was a little bit earlier, was that at least we knew then that immediate intervention would stop Gaddafi marching on Benghazi, and there was an absolute massacre that was just on the cusp of taking place.
It seems like the massacre has happened anyway.
Well, the thing is, Ed Miliband made a foreign policy speech last Friday at Chatham House, where he said exactly that it wasn't what happened in terms of the intervention that caused the problems in Libya. It was the lack of a plan afterwards. It was, you can't just go in and engage in a country and then withdraw and leave them to sort out the aftermath.
I mean, why are we engaging in foreign countries anyway?
Well, I think, you know, it's always a really difficult call. You're sat there in Parliament, and with the Syria vote, I was very conscious that if I voted for action, people would die, and if I voted against action, people would die. And it's a judgment call. As I said, I felt that it hadn't been properly thought through. There wasn't the international mandate. We didn't know who we would be arming if we armed the opposition, and now you look at ISIS.
Well, I mean,
and, you know,
ISIS are in Syria, so might it be okay to intervene in Syria to stop ISIS?
Well, I think you have to look at each case. I mean, if you look at, say, Kosovo, for example, you know, or Sierra Leone, there are examples where intervention does help and it's the right thing to do. But you need to look at what you're hoping to achieve, and you need to not abandon them to their fate once you've actually sort of, you know, gone in and done whatever action, military action you were proposing.
An exit strategy.
Well, it's not even just
Steve,
an exit strategy. It's a plan for helping
news.
Them govern the country.
Give Steve a chance
I'll
to
be as quick as I can,
UK.
Tony.
On 9/11 itself and the consequences.
I will agree with the rest of the panel.
I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. I think that we had an atrocious situation created by Tony Blair and George Bush, who took us into two wars that were built on a lie. And I personally believe that Tony Blair and George Bush are responsible for ISIS and Al-Qaeda. They created this situation. They've actually destroyed country after country, where those countries may have had a despot ruler, but they were to a point stable. They went in for one good reason: oil. And that's the only reason. We have a country in Africa which the people are being starved, where people are being murdered, but there's no oil. That's called Zimbabwe, and we have left that country alone, and Mugabe is one of the biggest mass murderers going.
So now, should we intervene in Zimbabwe?
No. We shouldn't have intervened in Syria, like we shouldn't have intervened in Afghanistan, and we shouldn't have intervened in Iraq. We should have left it and tried to use peaceful means for it. And we have to remember that those deaths on both sides have been caused by Tony and George.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 6.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.